Hello and welcome to Wooden Spoons on CKUW 95.9 FM. My name is John Dick, and I'm here with community nutritionist Mary Jane Eason to discuss topics of healthy living, environmental issues, what's going on in our community, as well as other interesting things in this one-hour show. On Wooden Spoons, we recognize that all things are related. With learning and awareness, we connect the dots that make up our world. Every Friday morning on Wooden Spoons, we speak with guests on today's relevant issues, share nutritious recipes, and explore important topics with perspectives not found in the mainstream media. Time right now is 8:01 a.m. and temperature outside is 14 degrees Celsius. Good morning, Mary Jane.
Good morning, John. How are you this morning?
I'm good. You?
I'm okay. Yes, I have an announcement to make. I don't know if you know about it, but the guest that was supposed to be coming on this morning had to cancel out late last night. So sometimes these things happen, and so I was sort of put in a bad situation here. So I had to make some adaptations for our program this morning. So we don't have a guest, and that means I'm going to have to do a lot more talking. But, I don't know if you knew about that, John, or not. I guess I didn't.
I did get your email on that, so yeah, I did know about that.
Oh, okay, because there was a lot of back and forth going on yesterday. And sometimes these things happen, but the guest that was planned for today will be coming on next week, as far as I understand. Well, actually, not next week, the week afterwards. So this morning, I would just like to acknowledge on Wooden Spoons that we are located on Treaty 1 territory, the traditional land and waters of the Cree, Ojibwe, Dakota, and Dene people, as well as the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis homeland. We also acknowledge the Shoal Lake No. 40 First Nation and its territory for our life-giving water. So this morning, our program is a bit changed, and so I have some information. I will just go over some of the things that I would like to cover this morning. And this is information from the Canadian Biotechnology Action Network, and it's a group of this particular organization brings together 15 organizations to research, monitor, and raise awareness about issues relating to genetic engineering in food and farming. So CBAN members include farmer associations. So it's a diverse group, and they're all united on protecting the natural way of farming and to bring out information about the dangers of genetic modification. And this has always been a sore point in Canada, because when genetic modification was introduced and was becoming was going to be established, there was a huge controversy going on with a lot of people at the University of Manitoba who were opposed to this type of technology. And there was, it wasn't a clear victory, but the thing that was most appealing and always is to people at every station of life is the fact that this technology would be bringing money into the institution, to the University of Manitoba. And so there was a lot of controversy about that, and anyway, unfortunately, Monsanto at the time, they started up their so-called Smart Park at the University of Manitoba. That was many years ago, And there were protests. There were protests by students and there were protests by others. And I was involved in those protests in front of Monsanto's Smart Park. Unfortunately, the University of Manitoba has adopted Monsanto's crops. University of Manitoba has made canola, their specialized oil, which is, you know, there's nothing wrong with the oil, the canola oil from the canola crops. However, the crops are genetically modified. So these are the things that are huge issues, and there are effects of genetic engineering. There are very bad side effects, and I wanted to talk about some of those. Unfortunately, the University of Manitoba, unfortunately, the government of Canada, which is Health Canada, and I keep saying Health Canada is not about the health of people, it is about the health of corporations. So Canada did not, there was not really, they just accepted it. And so Canadians were never informed, and Canadians still remain perhaps uninformed about what this technology is and why we should be concerned about it. There has never been any testing of genetic modified crops because nobody could get the gene sequences because it was their private ownership. Although there were a few studies that somehow they managed to second some of the genetic sequences and found out that it was not all what it seemed, that there were things to be concerned about. And Monsanto itself, they would destroy all the evidence after six months, when you would be able to start seeing effects of genetic modification on the animals that they studied, that's when they destroyed the evidence. So we are without able to test, and other scientists have not been able to test the genetic sequences because they didn't have ownership of it, et cetera. So that's the situation, sort of the background in my own way of explaining it, which might not be the best, but the best I can do. Anyway, so the Canadian Biotechnology Action Network is an organization that is concerning itself with genetic technology, this type of technology. And so I'm going to... I'm going to be reading. There has been some other issues that have developed, and I'm going to be just giving the information as provided by CBAN, and Lucy Charette is the coordinator of CBAN in Ottawa. So the three-year sustained global campaign has successfully ended what groups called a toxic alliance. This is between the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization and the biotechnology and pesticide industry lobby group CropLife International. CropLife International members include the largest biotechnology and pesticide companies in the world, and those are Bayer and Corteva and Syngenta. Monsanto is now has become Bayer. We hope that the toxic alliance goes down in history as an example of how the people's vigilance and resistance can block the most egregious forms of corporate capture. That's what the Pesticide Action Network International stated. In December 2020, the Food and Agricultural Organization and CropLife signed a letter of intent that CropLife called a strategic partnership agreement. At the time, the Food and Agricultural Organization press release announced that Food and Agricultural Organization and CropLife International that they strengthen commitment to promote agri-food systems transformation. Later, in response to global protests, the Food and Agricultural Organization tried to minimize the significance of the agreement. So this is what was at work behind the scenes between CropLife and the Food and Agriculture Organization. Now, since the agreement was announced between CropLife and the Food and Agriculture Organization, over 430 civil society and indigenous peoples organizations from nearly 70 countries, that was almost 200,000 individuals from over 107 countries, 250 scientists and academics, nearly 50 philanthropic groups, and the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food have all called on the Food and Agricultural Organization to rescind the agreement and stop the Toxic Alliance. The Toxic Alliance is the name of this plan to unite between Food and Agriculture, the cultural organization, and CropLife. So now that this whole thing has ended, so this is not going to happen. So Louise Charette says that we sincerely thank all individuals and organizations and peoples and other allies who supported the campaign to stop the Toxic Alliance. Let us continue to ensure that our global food systems are not captured by corporate interests and prioritize human rights and the planet over profit. And this is from the Pesticide Action Network International and the other 10 groups that spearheaded the global campaign. It should be noticed that herbicide sales went up 244% in Canada. The latest calculation finds that herbicide sales in Canada have increased by that amount since the introduction of genetically engineered, which is modified, GM crops. And that goes from 1991 to 2021. So all the GM crops currently grown in Canada have herbicide-tolerant traits, which means that they are all genetically engineered to withstand spraying by one or more herbicides. Some of these crop plants have other additional genetically modified traits. They have insect resistance in the case of GM corn and low lignin in the case of GM alfalfa, although there's not that many alfalfa that is genetically modified. Alfalfa doesn't need to be genetically modified. It's a very hardy plant, and it actually brings nutrients into the soil. And it's a very good, it doesn't need any genetic modification. Five genetically modified groups are grown in Canada. They are corn, canola, soy, white sugar beet, and a small amount of GM alfalfa. Additionally, the National Farmers Union reports that the total amount of pesticides sold for agricultural use in Canada has increased by more than three times from 1991 to 2021. Of this, 78% was herbicide, 13% was fungicide, and 5% was insecticide. So, the term pesticides includes herbicides, insecticides, and fungicides. So this is some information that we need to be aware of, that we are being exposed to more and more pesticides because the crops, the genetically modified crops, require them. And not only that, the pesticides that they use after a while don't work anymore because, like, the pesticide glyphosate, which is used in GM crops, they're finding out that a lot of weeds are resistant to the pesticide, so the pesticide doesn't work. So these are very concerning issues. And I'm going to be talking a little bit more about that. I want to talk about milkweeds. You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM. My name is Mary Jane Eastman, and this is Wooden Spoons, and we have John Dick as co-host. John, do you have any concerns about this, or any interest in this issue at all, or have you thought about it?
remind me what the issue is again.
I guess it's fairly, this information is quite new to you as well, isn't it?
Yeah, that's... Mm-hmm.
And it is for most people. They don't really, not really aware of what is going into our food. But we are aware, we should be aware of the fact that cancer has increased exponentially. And I keep thinking about this because in my grandmother's day, I have repeated this a number of times, cancer was so rare that when she had cancer, and that was a long time ago, they came to Canada at the turn of the century, 19... Oh, my goodness. I can't even remember. But anyway, my grandmother died before I was born, but she was taken into Winnipeg to be treated for cancer, and they couldn't find a place for her to stay because people didn't know what cancer was, and they thought it was contagious. That is how rare cancer was. So, and then... my aunt apparently found a place for her to stay. I learned all about this in a letter that I found. And when she left this place, they wanted my aunt to wash all the walls. That's how rare cancer was. People were afraid of it. They thought it was contagious. They didn't know anything about it. It was so rare. But cancer is a household word. It almost, like, that seems to be the most common thing that people get today, I think. One of the most common diseases. And there are reasons for that. Now, the Wilderness Committee, I want to share some information from them. The Wilderness Committee has also had some successful news to share. And Eric Ritter, he's the campaigner of the Wilderness Committee. He says that they are celebrating success in the Duck Mountain region of Western Manitoba as three First Nations now get a legal say in caring for the forests in their traditional territories. On June the 28th, Wisquay-Sipik First Nation and Menagozabeg Anishinaabe and Sapotawayak Cree Nation signed an agreement about logging in their territory with the Manitoba government. This was all caused by Louisiana Pacific Corporation's weak and incomplete 20-year forest management plan proposal. So the Louisiana Pacific was a corporation that had rights to logging in the Duck Mountain region. This agreement is an incredible accomplishment by these First Nations who took Louisiana Pacific and the Manitoba government to court multiple times over the course of 3 years. While the text is confidential, the broad strokes of the agreement are First Nations will be involved in all logging plans in the region of Louisiana Pacific's bad forest management proposal, and the Louisiana Pacific's bad forest management proposal will be shelved, and a new one jointly instituted instead, and new protected areas will be established. For years, the Wilderness Committee has been defending the forests of Western Canada, sharing our logging field research with First Nations and calling for First Nations to have decision-making authority over their territory. And so Eric Ritter says that the letters that people have written, because he's campaigned to get people to write letters to the government, have helped in this victory. So at the signing ceremony, Premier Wab Kanu spoke about his commitment to protecting 30% of lands and waters in Manitoba by 2030. And the Kettle Hills region has already been mentioned by First Nations for a new protected area. now that the Duck Mountain region is in the hands of First Nations instead of only Logging Corporation Louisiana Pacific, we are hopeful the process of decolonizing Duck Mountain Provincial Park can accelerate, which will include an end to park logging in Manitoba. So this is a very important thing that happened, ending the logging in our parks. So Eric wants to thank the Wisquisific First Nation and the Menegozilabic Anishinaabe for the energy and resources they've spent on four legal cases gaining better forest care in Western Manitoba. So that's the letter from Eric Redder, and he's the campaigner for the Wilderness Committee. So I think at this time, John, do we have, would you like to play a song? We'll have a break and we'll come back to more talking about other environmental issues.
Yeah, I believe the first song requested is In the Summertime by Mungo Jerry. I'll put that on right now.
See what you can find. If a daddy's rich, take her out for a meal. If a daddy's poor, just do what you feel. Speed along the lane, you can down or return to 25. When the sun goes down, you can make it good and lay by. When I grab people, when I dirty, when I mean, we love everybody, but we do as we please. When the weather's fine, we go fishing or go sailing in the sea. We're always happy, last we're living, yeah, that's our philosophy. Sing along with us, dee 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 dee, da 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 da, yeah, we're happy. Da da da, dee da da dee da 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 da. Summertime and we'll sing again. We go driving or maybe we'll settle down. If she's rich, if she's nice, bring your friends and we'll all go into town. See what you can find. If a daddy's rich, take her out for a meal. If a daddy's poor, just do what you feel. Speed along the lane, you can down or return to 25. When the sun goes down, you can make it good and lay by. When I grab people, when I dirty, when I mean, we love everybody, but we do as we please. When the weather's fine, we go fishing or go swimming in the sea. We're always happy, lives we're living, yeah, that's our philosophy. Sing along with us, dee 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 dee, da 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 da, yeah, we're happy, happy. Da da da, dee da da dee da 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 da.
Okay. So, John, do you want to give us the time and temperature?
Time right now is 8:24 a.m. Temperature outside is 14 degrees Celsius. I just had some like other comments on just the stuff you were talking about. You said that like I don't know, cancer rates have gone way up, and are you saying that like you think that ultra processed foods is why that is, or just to clarify that?
Well, I think that really our best bet is to focus on whole foods, which is foods like fruits and vegetables that you cook yourself. When you're getting a lot of processed foods, a lot of the nutrients are removed, and then there's usually different additives added to it. So, you know, you can get some good foods, too, that are processed, and there are very healthy bakeries like Tallgrass and Hildegard's and so on, and they use the whole grains. But very often when you're buying processed foods, you use the white flour has been depleted of its nutrients, and so it's kind of returning to a more natural food. And I know, you know, we are very dependent on snack foods and things like that, but they don't really build your health at all. So I am a promoter of the natural foods and the whole foods, which is foods as they are in more or less in nature, which means you have to cook more for yourself. So I don't know how you feel about that, John. That's probably rather a threatening situation for you to think about.
Yeah, like what I've heard is that like fast food companies and companies that make just like snack foods, like they'll hire food scientists just to, you know, come up with the combination of whatever preservatives that are designed to be the most addictive to us. So not even necessarily like the best tasting, but just to be addictive, to make us crave it. And there's no nutritional value in anything that they eat. I don't know if they're like causing cancer. Like I'm still a bit skeptical about that, but I know that they're not good for us. Like the cancer thing, there could be like a number of variables there. It's not like entirely caused by, you know, fast food, junk food, but I do think that like it's not that crazy to think that that would contribute to it. So yeah, that's my thoughts there.
Yeah, well, you know, what we're talking about, vitamins and minerals, but you know, when we get our vitamins and minerals in our food, they are not separate, they are connected with each other, so they form a network. When you get it from fast foods, these vitamins and minerals are separate, and our bodies don't deal with it in the same way. So they're not as effective. So but that's another issue. But yeah, there's I think glyphosate is a big issue because when our crops are, we're using foods, you know, that are like canola oil, for instance. You can get organic canola oil that does not have glyphosate in it. It's not treated with those chemicals. But the University of Manitoba is promoting canola oil as a very healthy oil, which it would be had it not been for the glyphosate that is part of the growing the crop, you know, that sort of thing. So it's, as you're saying, you're looking into things, you have to think about it. You can't just, like, food technology is a big, big industry, and it's all about, it's amazing. Like, they spend so much money in doing taste testing to see what people, what they like and how they can influence their tastes or... it's a big, big industry, and it's not about health. It's about promoting a product. Food technology is a very big industry. So anyway, that's quite an in-depth topic in itself. I wanted to talk a little bit about milkweed because Milkweed is an indigenous plant, and I'm just going to see the milkweed has the milkweed that grows wild is food for the monarch butterfly, and the monarch butterfly. I don't think it was a wonderful program on TV the other day about the flight of the monarch butterfly. They fly all the way across North America, all the way to Mexico every year. It is just phenomenal the how they do this. But they need to have food along the way, and milkweed is their food. They definitely depend on milkweed, and they lay their eggs on the milkweed, and the caterpillars form a chrysalis, and they are actually, I'm not sure if they go in the milkweed or try to go someplace else, but anyway, the milkweed is something that the caterpillar needs. They live on the leaves of the milkweed as they're growing, and then they turn into a butterfly afterwards. So anyway, the milkweed decline is strongly correlated with the use of herbicide-resistant crops. And it says here, pesticides and pollinators, a 2020 study from the United States found that milkweed plants, which are the main source of food for monarch butterflies, were contaminated with 64 types of pesticide residues. And the monarch butterfly populations have shrunk to 1% of their numbers in the last three decades. So the study said they expected to find some pesticides in these plants, but they were surprised by the depth and extent of the contamination, said Matt Forrester, a butterfly expert and biology professor at the University of Nevada, Reno, and co-author of the paper. From roadsides, from yards, from wildlife refuges, even from plants bought at stores, doesn't matter from where, it's all loaded with chemicals, he says. We have previously suggested that pesticides are involved in the decline of low elevation butterflies in California. But the ubiquity and diversity of pesticides we found in these milkweeds was a surprise. There are other sources. It says here that the world one of the commentary on pesticide toxicity. The world's most used weed killer is probably carcinogenic. So what? Meg Sears says, Meg from Prevent Cancer Now, that's her topic. Synthetic pesticides are not permitted for use in organic food production. And so this is information on the organic standard in Canada. Organizations with up-to-date information on pesticide toxicity and related issues are Equitare Canada, Prevent Cancer Now Canada, and that's the organization that Meg Sears is involved with. And I've had her several times on Wooden Spoons, and the Pesticide Action Network North America. The glyphosate is the world's most used chemical ingredient for weed control. It is a probable human carcinogen. 2,4-D, the second most used herbicide in Canada, is a possible human carcinogen. And when they use these terms, possible or things like that, that means that there's evidence there of carcinogen activity and harm. The milkweed decline, and also the fact that the butterflies depend on milkweed, is a concern for the survival of the monarch butterfly. It should be noted that herbicide sales in Canada have increased. I'm not sure if I said this already, but it has increased by 244% since genetically modified crops have been introduced between 1994 and 2021. So those are some of the things that that we need to be concerned about in our food, and we need to be moving away from herbicides and pesticides as much as possible. For one thing, the plants they become immune to the pesticides after a while, and they develop resistance to the pesticides, and so we have all these glyphosate-resistant weeds growing, and so that's why Monsanto and now Bayer has to find other new pesticides. So it's always that kind of thing going on. And then there is a very important movement about the importance of indigenous plants. And there's the book. There's a book that I had been reading, and it's by Doug Ptolemy, and Nature's Best Hope, it's called. And he's written many books, so this is an excellent book to get. I got it from McNally's bookstore. I had to order it in because the last one got taken or used, and so it's a very popular book. And Wendy Bulow was, I think she was the one that introduced me to this book. And she's interested in growing all sorts of natural types of plants in the country, and fostering the growing of indigenous plants. And indigenous plants are plants that have been in our environment forever. And they have a relationship. They have they're established in the ecosystem, so they work. Indigenous plants support nature. Indigenous plants support caterpillars, and we should not be killing caterpillars. Caterpillars are very, very important as pollinators. The insects that pollinate plants come from caterpillars. And so we need the bees and the different types of insects that pollinate our plants. Without the plants being pollinated, they will not grow and go into seed. And a lot of plants, alfalfa plants and all these plants, they need the insects that trigger that when the insects try to get the pollen from the plants or the nectar. They trigger pollination in the plants so that they are able to reproduce. So the indigenous plants are very connected with continuing the healthy growth of plants that support the ecosystem. Now, caterpillars are very important because birds need caterpillars on which to live. And so caterpillars feed the birds, so it all works together. So we should not be worried about caterpillars. And the spraying of cankerworms is very, very, very ignorant. It is unnecessary, and it's the cankerworms are food for different types of birds. There's a number of birds that do eat cankerworms. And I had a list of them, and I just can't remember them. They were nuthatches and titmice type of birds. And there's a whole list of birds that depend on, that will eat cankerworms. And so we're feeding the birds. The reason people spray cankerworms is not because they're harmful. They're not harmful at all. It's just that maybe we don't like them. Or maybe they fall on our cars or something like that. But that's not a reason to spray I mean, we are not the center of the universe. We have to start growing out of that mentality. I'm not sure how we got that mentality, but I have my own ideas about that too. But we are not the center of the universe. We are in relationship with everything. We are like other creatures, although we are more, in many ways, dominant. But we have to, we are at our own risk by acting like we are the center of the universe and can do what we want. So I really oppose the spraying of cankerworms. And so that's just one of the things that seems to be happening. Indigenous plants, like some of them are, it's hard to know what they are, but I just found out from Wendy when I was talking to her that, burdock. I thought burdock was indigenous. She says, no, it is not indigenous. It is very invasive, and that much I can tell. I have burdock growing all over the place. So she says to dig it out because it is not indigenous. And, you know, so it doesn't really, it has no, it does not support the ecosystem. And it takes over everything. So I have that, I'm glad that she told me that because I thought it was indigenous and it isn't. And but goldenrods are indigenous and they are very important plants to have in your yard. They're very good pollinators. Their flowers come out in the late summer and fall. And many types of insects use them. So goldenrods are a good plant to have. And asters are another indigenous plant. So we have to start finding ways of sources of indigenous plants, which is another thing. You can't really depend on going to the regular stores and getting plants that are indigenous because most of the plants that they sell are not. So I know there are places, but they may not be that accessible. Wendy Bulow is going to be joining us on another program, and we're going to be talking about that as well. Nettles are indigenous, and nettles are also very good. We can use nettles for teas, and they're full of minerals. However, one should not be eating nettles, making teas out of nettles, if it's growing into seed. My daughter, who's a naturopath in Calgary, she told me that. She said, if the nettles are going into seed and you make a tea out of them, they will cause a urinary tract irritation. So that's good for people to know because nettles themselves, when they're early in the spring, before they get seeds, like the stems start developing seeds, before that happens, the nettles can be used for a very healthy tea. And it can be used in cooking as well, although I've not really tried it. But it is it's not a bad thing to eat. It's like a spinach. So now there's another plant that seems to be very invasive, and it's in my yard. It is lily of the valley, and it has a beautiful smell. So I was told that this is not an indigenous plant either. And Wendy thought that it was toxic to the soil, it has poison in it, or it poisons the soil. But I talked to my daughter, and I think my daughter, as a naturopath, she studies plants a lot, and she knows more about plants than most people do. And she said, lily of the valley does have medicinal properties. It actually has substances that are good for the heart. So it can be a source of medicine. But I'm not recommending that anybody tries it, but just the fact that it does have these substances in them. So I don't feel the same way about lily of the valley or concerned about that. Speaking of the natural world, my daughter from Calgary went on a special trip, and this sort of came out of the blue. She went there for 10 days. I think it was Stonehenge in England. It was, I know very little about it, but except that she said it was the most amazing place she ever saw in her life. And this area was so pristine. She said the water, she'd never tasted water that tasted so good. It was flowing out of a stream. And the place was just absolutely pristine. She said there were huge oak trees as well. And some of them were like 400 years old. And the oak trees were full of animals. She saw a fox and a number of different animals that were there. And they had some different ceremonies. It was a place of the Druids years ago. I don't know the history of these places, but the Druid civilization was in that area. And it's very secluded. She said it's magical. And they had a solstice ceremony there and the full moon ceremony all on the same day. So she was telling me about this place, and I thought it was very interesting to know about it, especially when I've been reading about oak trees from Doug Ptolemy's book, Nature's Best Hope, and the importance of oak trees in our ecosystem, because oak trees apparently are very, very helpful to the environment. They are very good, especially in our concern about climate change, of taking the carbon from the atmosphere and depositing it in the soil. So it's bringing carbon, it pulls carbon from the atmosphere and puts it into the soil. Now, the acorns themselves do not feed, I don't know if they're eaten by anything, but and the leaves and so on, but the leaves, you know, provide a cover that apparently is very good, especially in certain parts of the country in the United States where they have cicadas that come out. I mean, cicadas go into hibernation for a long, long time, and then after so many years, then they come out. So the oak trees, the leaves of the oak trees, form a bed that's very protective of many insects that need that protection. So that's kind of interesting. But if you're going to buy an oak tree to plant, the best time would be to plant it in the fall, where the root system can have a chance to grow naturally and develop, rather than in the spring when often the roots are cut off and then the plant has a hard time, the oak has a hard time to develop a root system. So Wendy Bulow was the one that told me that the best time to grow an oak, to plant an oak tree, is in the fall. And the other thing you have to make sure is that it hasn't been sprayed with pesticides. So sometimes they actually, this is one of the things you have to find out from the nursery, have they put pesticide inside the oak tree? Because if they do, then the oak tree itself is not, it will have toxins in it. So that's just another consideration. John, can we have some station ID right now and gain a temperature and time for this morning?
For sure. You are listening to CKUW 95.9 FM. Time right now is 8:48 a.m. and temperature outside, it's refreshing, hang on, is 16 degrees Celsius.
Okay, so do you think we could have another song and then I will have a recipe to end this program?
Yes, this is Little Green Bag by George Baker.
That sounds good.
Losing my mind. Outside in the night, outside in the day. Looking back on the track, gonna do it my way. Outside in the night, outside in the day. Looking back on the track, gonna do it my way. Looking back.
little green bank. Got to find just a kind of losing my mind. All of a sudden in the night, all of a sudden today, looking back on a track that I do it my way. Looking back on a track for a little, little green bank. Got to find just a kind of losing my mind.
We're back. Thanks for the song. I have a recipe I would like to share as we end this program on Wooden Spoons this morning. I've been going to the farmer's market. I actually just started, and I was very fortunate to be able to find a stand that had these beautiful collard greens. They were the best I've ever seen. They were flat leaves, green leaves. They're called collards. They had very thick stems, so I bought a bunch. I wished I had bought more. Anyway, I decided to make cabbage rolls out of the collard greens, so I'm just going to give a recipe for that. It's something that, it's not that I have a recipe written down about it, but I can just tell you how it's done. First of all, the collard greens were very large, so you have to cut the stems out. The stems are hard or firm. It'll be hard to bend the leaves if you have the stems in. So you cut out the stems, and then you cut the collard greens into pieces that are fairly large because they're going to be used instead of cabbage for cabbage rolls. So then you take a pot of water, bring it to a boil, and put the leaves in the boiling water. And you don't have to leave it very long. It's just to soften the leaves. And then and then with tongs, you take them out and cool them off and lay them on a cutting board or whatever until you're ready to use them. So once you've blanched them in boiling water, then you can actually save the water that you use for blanching, because that's like, in a way, it has different nutrients in it from the collard leaves. And it's very much like when you're cooking vegetables, you should always save the water and cool it, put it in the refrigerator, and use it for your soups. So that's conserving nutrients. Anyway, so you have the collard greens, and now you have to have some rice. And you can use brown rice or white rice, and you need to cook the rice. It takes about 20 minutes to cook white rice. I think I don't need to explain how to cook rice, I hope. You just boil some water, and actually you need about 2 cups of water for 1 cup of rice. And so I think in this recipe, I'm going to say, if you have a whole bunch of collard greens, you could take 2 cups of rice, and then that'll become 4 cups when it's cooked. If you're using brown rice, it's a different story, because brown rice takes 45 minutes to cook. Brown rice, of course, is more nutritious because the bran is still on, or some of the bran. Well, the bran isn't on, but you have, it has more of the outer coating of the nutrients from the outer coating. Also, there's another type of rice called parboiled rice, where the rice is put under some pressure, and it forces the nutrients from the outer coating to go into the rice. It's called parboiled rice, it's more nutritious than just white rice. So before they take the outer coating off, part of this goes through a treatment where through heat treatment forces nutrients into the rice itself, and that's parboiled rice. And it's a little bit, it's not quite white. It's a bit more, a little bit, it has a beige tinge to it. So that would be the next best thing to brown rice would be the parboiled rice. White rice is pretty much denuded of nutrients because all the outer nutrients are removed with the bran. Anyway, so much for that. So anyway, you cook your rice, and then you're going to prepare, then you need to cook some lentils. You can use brown lentils and cook them. Then you take the rice and you can saute the rice with some onions and add the lentils, salt and pepper. And then you take the collard greens and put some rice in the middle, and you fold it up, wrap it up so it's all tucked in, and you place it in a casserole dish. And you do that with all the pieces of collard greens that you have. And then you will cover it with some tomato sauce, which you can make yourself. You can use canned tomatoes. You can puree them. Saute them in a little bit of onion and garlic. Put some basil in there to your taste and a bay leaf. And then you can pour that over your collards in a casserole dish and bake it in the oven at about, you don't want to have it too high of a temperature, like maybe 325 degrees, maybe for 20 minutes until everything is sort of blended together. And you can test them out if the collards are soft. When you pierce them with a fork or a knife, you know they're done. So that's a very good recipe, and you can use the hamburger meat instead of rice if you prefer. But either way, it's a very good thing to make, and hope that you try it out if you can find the collards at the farmers markets. So I think this ends our program of Wooden Spoons. I'd like to thank everybody for listening to our program this morning. And thank you, John, for keeping the program going. And next week we will be having a guest, Fran and Dan Druk from On Top of the Hill Farm, as our guests next Friday morning. Thank you for listening.
You have been listening to Wooden Spoons, sponsored by Mary Jane's Cooking School on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. For a podcast, please go to ckuw.ca, type Wooden Spoons into the search bar, and the program will be up in just a few hours. Until next time, this is John Dick and Mary Jane Eason saying bye for now, and thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!